Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Fred Monroe is hosting the program from home today amid concerns about the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Today, Fred and his guests will be looking at the Central Coast Writers Conference as it goes virtual in 2020. Once again, Central Coast Voices will preview of this conference's 36th year. While all virtual this year, the conference team promises attendees insightful dialogue, networking, access, and a diverse and gifted group. The Central Coast Writers Conference was named the best conference in the West by Writers Magazine. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation today by calling us at 805-549-8855, or you can email your questions to us at voices@kcbx.org. Fred, how are you doing today?
Pretty good, Sarah. Glad you're with us, too. And we'll have a great time talking about this. This is something we've talked about a number of times. I have to confess, the first time I did a program about the Central Coast Writers Conference, my first thought to Terry Bayes, who's the executive director, and she's one of our guests today, was how can we get writers to talk for an hour about writing? Don't they write instead? And boy, was I mistaken about that. Anyway, Terry Bayes is the conference director, and she's been doing that for 5 years. Our guests today also include Phil Cousinau. He's an award-winning writer and filmmaker, teacher, editor, lecturer, and actually travel writer. And Jordan Rosenfeld, and she is a teacher, author, novelist, and what I have to just put this in here from my perspective, and that is that she's also a manuscript editor. And if you are a writer at all and you understand the frustration of writing the way you want and having it still readable, a manuscript editor is a fascinating person that you want to make sure you know and that they like you. So that's an important thing too. And Jordan's going to be with the conference also. The planning for this conference probably made Terry a little crazy because it is going to indeed be a virtual conference. She's going to tell us a little about how they're doing that. We're at least to the point now where probably everybody in the world has done at least 5 or 10,000 virtual events by this part of the year, and hopefully we'll be out of this in a while. But Terry and her crew are going to show us how to do a writers' conference by virtual also. You can be part of the discussion today if you have any questions or observations you want to add to the discussion. The phone number is 805-549-8855. You can also email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. If they're rather involved or intricate questions we can't get to on the air, I will make sure our guests all get that information forwarded to them. But we want you to be part of the discussion. If you're a writer, please don't spend your time showing us how well you can write a novella. We would like a simple question, and we would like you to be part of the conversation today. So please join us. Anyway, and Terry, it's up to you. Tell me how you're going to do it this year, and we'll start with you. And you have to allow me time to also get into some of your personal writing style, because I have some fascinating questions about that.
Thank you, Fred. Yeah, so this year we decided to go virtual, where most of the conferences canceled, but I decided that in this time, the writing was more important than anything. And I believe that the artists will heal the whole world better than anybody else. So, and we have the most inspiring and inspirational people on our staff. So we decided to do it via Zoom. So we're following the same procedures that we did in person. So it'll be a Thursday, Friday, Saturday conference. Thursday will be master classes, 5 different master classes with a keynote by Christopher Moore in the evening. And then on Friday, we have an opening keynote with Jordan Rosenfeld. And then we have classes all the way till 6 o'clock. And then we have a wonderful filmmaker. Her name is Kara Bolton, who is creating a film where she is learning to swim in the Caribbean and diving on slave ships. And we're going to talk about her journey. It's an accidental journey that she got on. She doesn't know how to swim, and she's a person of color, and now she's doing this amazing thing. And then on Saturday we have workshops all the way from 9 o'clock till 6 o'clock, and then a closing keynote with Monica Piper, who wrote several sitcoms and is the creator of Rugrats. So it's each of the classes are an hour long. We have 60 different classes taught by 50 different personnel. So there's a little bit of everything there, from screenwriting to poetry to novels, nonfiction, and business and agents.
Good. I want to interject an observation about doing it by Zoom, because I suspect you're getting some people who are saying, oh, I don't want to go to a conference by Zoom. I would suggest to a lot of your attendees, and maybe some of your skeptics from that standpoint, that one of the things that Zoom seems to have given us is the ability to include people as presenters and attendees that could not otherwise come to the Central Coast, in your case. I suspect there are people who are spread thin across the world on a good month. But if everybody is doing this by virtual connection, you have the advantage of someone who happens to be somewhere in Southeast Asia can't say to you, gee, I can't get to San Luis Obispo for the conference. You'll have to pick me some other time. If they've got a Zoom connection, it'll work. Have you been able to bring some people into this mix that were kind of off the available chart for you until you decided to do it by Zoom?
Yeah, we have one of our instructors is coming in from Australia, so she'll be teaching a day and a half ahead of us. We have several from New York, and Bill was supposed to be in Greece at this time, so we didn't think we had him, but now we have him in San Francisco. So, and the advantage of this is that because we've never been able to capture every single workshop, so in including the really big dip in price, everybody who signs up will get every single workshop as a video link afterwards. So that alone is worth its price in gold, that you can watch these workshops at your leisure whenever you want.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the best tools that you can offer, and that is the fact that something that I could not get to on Saturday because there was either I had a schedule conflict or there were other things going on that I wanted to see and I couldn't see everything, that those are available to you. Pardon me, down the road a little bit. I want to get to a couple of things. Jordan, I want to make sure you still got a link. You're there.
Okay. I'm here.
You have some fascinating writing background. I went to both yours and Phil's websites and looked at some information. This is kind of the question I would ask I wouldn't ask any writer because it wouldn't fit for any writer, but it's important to me to get an understanding of different writing styles and how you adapt to different things, because you have done something that's a head scratcher for me. And if I'd had enough time before the program, I would have tried to track down the actual articles, but you have been published in both the Atlantic Magazine and the New York Times, which have got some good crossover. And you've also been published in the New York Times and Scientific American, which have some crossover. But I need an explanation for what you wrote for the Atlantic and what you wrote for Scientific American, because I would generally have to say, I think of those are coming from two different writing styles and two different perspectives that may not fit together in the writing world. Mm. So obviously that's not the case.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you have to start, or where I would start to answer that is to think of the freelance writer, which is what I am, meaning someone who comes up with your own ideas and pitches those to magazines, as a kind of Renaissance writer. So, you know, it's the hustle, right? I'm trying to find work. I'm going to look at magazines that interest me. I'm going to try and come up with ideas. But the other thing that I've come across, so for the Atlantic, I actually wrote a story about the the unaffordability of yoga, of all things. It was originally inspired by a program that was bringing yoga to people who couldn't access it otherwise. That was the motivation. And then I looked at other avenues where that was the case. So that's not necessarily what you'd expect The Atlantic to write about. And for Scientific American, I wrote about a concept that this researcher put together called environmental grief, where she feels that in the wake of climate change, with all kinds of ecosystems and species being both lost and impacted, that people are experiencing this grief. So there's actually maybe more crossover in those ideas than you might think. But what it comes down to is this: as a freelance writer, as a journalist, you can learn enough about a subject to write about it for a number of different publications. It's a lot harder to teach a scientist or a economist to write for a lay audience. So that's kind of where a lot of editors come from. I trust that if I give this freelancer an assignment, they're going to research it. They're going to use, primary sources and studies, and they can give me 750 words that make sense. Whereas if I ask a scientist to write about this topic, they're going to give me a 20-page academic paper that I have to break down. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
it does. And the word that came to mind as you were saying that is, there are sometimes that a good writer's naivete on a subject going in may be what makes the best writer.
Mm-hmm. I think that, there's a lot to be said for bringing someone to a subject who's not deeply immersed in it. I'm for both the reason of biases and assuming, when you know a subject so well, you can assume that the reader will also know it and forget to explain things that are necessary. So I do think there's some advantage, though I'm sure that scientists and economists would argue that we don't tell the full story sometimes.
Well, I think some of the economists and the scientists may actually be wrapped up in telling too much of the full story, which puts us all asleep on page 852.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, Phil, you've tied something together, and I watched one of your TED Talks, and I've also looked at some of your travel information, because the travel industry is what I do at her day job. And you've done something that I think is fascinating when I look at you as both a writer and as a presenter, and that is carrying over history and current situations into your writing style. I suspect you've probably trained more travel writers than you realize, and that you haven't trained them by sitting down with them face to face. You've trained them by having them read your travel literature material and listen to what you present in some of your travel talks. Is there a difference in style when you write for an oral presentation? Have you found that there's any consistency with how you write for an oral presentation versus how you write for a written word presentation?
Now, there's a lot packed into those serial questions. Let me back up and just say hello, San Luis Obispo. Hello, writers around the world. We love you. We need you. Come and help us change the world. So I was born on the knee of Homer. Do you remember that old phrase? People used to say that if you read the classics, anywhere from Homer to Mark Twain, you were raised on the knee of Homer. So you were raised with stories, and that's what this conference is about. Do you have a story? Are you on fire about telling it to the world? That's why we are here, all these teachers and presenters, writers that Terry has brought together. In my case, I grew up reading. I was also a jock, and that wasn't a pleasant thing in the beginning. You either read, you're either a bookworm or an athlete. I was both. But I was also born with this inbred desire to see the things that I read about. So I had to go to Greece because I loved the Greek myths. I had to go to New Bedford, Massachusetts, because I read Moby Dick with my father when I was a boy. So the combination of these two, reading, researching, and travel, has been natural for me all my life. And I travel, but I also film. I'm a documentary filmmaker, so I film all around the world. And I find one of the most effective ways of teaching writing is to go to a place that is rich with literary lore. So I teach writing retreats in Paris, in the west of Ireland, and in the Greek islands. Not to be fancy. This is nothing to do with trendiness. What it has to do with is creating a kind of alembic where you are alone with other writers, kindred spirits, thinking about one thing, your story, and how do I get my story out into the world? As far as the preparation goes, I outline all my public talks. I've given 1,000 talks around the world, but I then improvise. So I have never read, it would be reprehensible for me to read a paper in public. I extemporize, I'm a storyteller. When I write for publication, I write and polish and burnish again and again and again. And then as the poet William Merwin once asked, one of the central questions for any creative writer is, who should I show this to? That's a delicate moment in the world of creative writers. You don't necessarily want to show it to your mother because she has to love it, right? Or even your best friends. But show your literary work, your creative writing, to creative literary writers to get deep, soulful feedback. And that's what I think a conference like this can offer. Those of us who are on all these panels and teaching the classes have been writing not just for ourselves, because that can just be confessional. If you want to be a creative writer, an artist, you are writing to communicate. This is an important word that isn't often emphasized enough. To get your word, your story, your insight out into the world. And the last note on that is to be timely, to be out of the moment. James Baldwin. I think one of the most important books that's been published recently is by Eddie Goodell's book on James Baldwin, Begin Again. And in there, Terry, this is for you, where he says, the bottom line is, isn't that a great beginning? The bottom line is you write to change the world. Now, you probably can't or won't, but you write because you believe that literature is indispensable for the soul of the world. That is the fire that I will be talking about in my workshops and my classes. Where is your fire? What are you on fire about now? Because without the fire, you can't begin and you can't finish.
I love you, Phil.
Yeah. Phil, I've got a zillion questions here for that. The one that comes to mind first that I'll get out of the way because it may be the simplest, or maybe it may have the simplest answer or the shortest answer. And I respect you and admire the fact that you don't have short answers. I think that makes things far more interesting, especially when I'm doing an hour radio program. you've done a lot of things that are based upon Irish, going to Ireland. And it occurred to me as I was looking through some of your background and your work with Ireland and your travel work, is everybody seems to think that all the authors and all the poets of Ireland are a magnet. Okay, it's not that big a country, it doesn't have that many people, but I know actors and I know musicians that do, and in your case, I know a writer that does, travel groups to, and Ireland seems to be the ones that fill up the fastest and get kind of jump out there with people wanting to grab hold of them. What is it about Ireland? But as a writer, I guess, what is it about Irish literature that makes that such a magnet?
Well, speaking for myself, Ireland is a magnet for writers because writers are respected there. Every dime, nickel, or penny farthing that you earn is actually tax-free in Ireland. The only place in the world that I know of like this. You go into a pub and you open up your manuscript and you begin working on it. You're not tossed out on your ear because you're a heretic. somebody will come up to you, as it's often happened all around Ireland, and ask, would you like a pint, lad? I see smoke coming off those pages. Would you like a pint, lad? So you're embraced rather than rejected or repelled in a country like Ireland. And everyone, including your postal carrier, your nurse, everyone is a storyteller, broadly speaking. And I think that helps, where you're not an outcast. You are raised in a world that began under the ancient Celts with stories, where stories and words themselves were actually sacred things, all the way up to James Joyce and Seamus Heaney, who was just quoted in the Democratic Conventions, are respected there. And that is helpful in the broader sense, because writing is a very solitudinous life, and it helps to have kindred spirits. So you go to a place where people are writing, where they respect you as writers, and something, the embers in your creative soul are kindled and fanned in a place like this. And I think the broader, our writers' conferences, I think, are the equivalent of Irish pubs for the writer's soul.
Okay. Terry, there's a theme there for next year.
Oh no, we will embrace the drinking element. Yeah. It's the one thing I'm missing most about the virtual thing. I can't figure out how we're going to do that part.
Well, nobody has to drive anywhere. It's okay. So anyway, Jordan. By the way, you don't have to necessarily get involved in the discussion about the drinking hour at the conference. I don't know where Terry was going with that.
No comment.
You're the keynote on Friday, and the word that jumps off the page for me, or two words that jump off the page for me with regard to your keynote, are about staying persistent. And A Writer's Guide to Persistence. And so that's both part of a book that you've written, but that's also the focus of your keynote, as I understand it. I think as a group, sometimes writers may tend to not be good salespersons. And so I think what you're talking about in your issues of persistence indeed have to do with how well you can sell someone. The writing will sell it eventually, but if you can't get someone to sit down and read it, it doesn't matter how well the writing will sell. So I'm wondering how you lead with that, and what you do to help maybe first time people who are trying to get published for the first time.
Yeah, good question. The idea of persistence for me does not start at the end point where we talk about selling the book, marketing the book, or publishing the book. For me, really the core of this book and this concept has to do a lot with the front end and how you create and develop a writing practice. Because a writing practice is what will keep you coming back to the page, revising your work, sticking with it when you get rejections, which are a natural part of the process. So for me, and I won't give too much away about the keynote, but in general, it's all about building that front side route. It's kind of like I talk a lot about, I make a joke that, you know, when you look at people who practice yoga, and here we are back somehow on the subject of yoga. I really don't write about yoga very often, I want you to know. I love it, but, you know, yogis don't have like, I got to get in 15 poses today, or I'm not a good writer. You know, they don't whip themselves over, at least not the ones that I know. It's like, it's part of something they do every day that makes them feel good. Sometimes maybe they have a vigorous, you know, practice, and some days they might have some restorative poses. I don't know. So for me, if you have to cultivate this relationship to your writing, and it has to matter to you, it has to be grounded in, purpose and passion and curiosity, all these words you want to throw out there, whatever floats your boat and makes you excited, whether it's, you know, flying to Ireland with Phil and in the days when we can ever do that again, or it's, you know, just showing up for yourself every day. So for me, when it comes down to actually getting published, if you've done the work of building this deep writing practice, then when you get you know, a critique that's harsh, or the agents that you pitch aren't going for it, you're not just going to go, oh, well, I guess I'm not a good writer, I guess I'll give up. You're going to say, oh yeah, it's part of my writing practice. Rejection is just means I have to do a little bit more work or look somewhere else. And you keep coming back to it. And that keeping coming back to it, to me, is the persistence part. So I also tell people that you get to count everything, you know, the 20 minutes in your shower when you're thinking about your book counts as writing. That Netflix documentary you had to watch to research your book counts as writing. So if you incorporate all those things instead of seeing them as, oh, I didn't write today, you know, well, did you think about your book? Did you make notes on it? You get to count it as writing. So that's more of where my philosophy is coming from than I do have ideas about publishing and sales, but they're not my favorite ideas. They're not my favorite subject. That is probably true of writers. We don't like to talk about selling books as much as we like to talk about writing them and making them. I don't know. So
I just want to interject that the very first time I went to the Central Coast Writers Conference as an attendee, it took me 3 years to get there. I was terrified to go because I was convinced I wasn't a writer, even though I wrote a column every week for the newspaper. That my very first class I went to was Jordan Rosenfeld, and she lit my hair on fire, and I have not stopped writing since. I admire this woman probably more than any other teacher that we've ever had. So,
well, and that's a very good point, because I suspect that we get some incredibly good writers who are not good at teaching their craft. Mm-hmm. I suspect you may have, whether it be this conference or other conferences, you may, as I'm sure that specifically that Phil and Jordan have run into this, and Terry may have run into it at Central Coast, but you may end up with writers in your class, whether it be just a general session or a master class, that you're surprised to see them sitting there. And the answer might be, you know, I can write well, or what I've done has gone well, but it's not what I really want to be writing, or how I really want to present it. So I suspect that most good writers never tire of growing.
No, that's one of the things that's so wonderful about the conference is we have over 52 teachers, and each of them attend each other's workshops. I mean, when I'm setting their schedules, they specifically tell me, don't schedule anything during Phil's talk because I'm going in there. And these are world-class writers. They know that all of us know that to continue writing and to continue being relevant and helping to heal the world, we have to keep learning, because this isn't like a brain surgery that there's one way to do it. This is an art form, and everybody has a different way of approaching this art form. And every single time I hear somebody critique a class and say, well, I got this from it, then I'll have someone else say, I got this from it. So you have 50 students in the class, and they're all getting something different from this very same instructor.
Mm-hmm. Can I hitchhike on that point for a second?
Go ahead. Yes, please.
I'm a word guy. I've written a few books on word origins. Mm-hmm. When I was reading all those classics with my dad when I was a kid, and we came across a sesquipedalian word, a foot and a half long, he wouldn't tell us what the word meant. He would say, go over to the dictionary in the corner and look it up. That's why I bought the damn thing. So when I wrote Stoking the Creative Fire is my book that's addressed to people who are stuck for any reason at the beginning, the middle, or the end of a creative project, I found that I had to look up the origins of create. It seems so obvious, right? As many of our words do. But I was astonished, and it's become part of my riff now. Originally, to create meant to grow, to make order out of the chaos, to produce something that the world has never seen before. But that first element, to grow, reminds me of Bob Dylan. He who isn't busy being born is busy dying. Do you remember that old great song, the lyric of his? That is something in the heart of all creative people. If I am not making something today, it's a wasted day in my life. It's not quite French Catholic guilt, although there may be a little bit of that in me. It's something else. It's closer to the existential itch. You have to scratch that itch to grow, to become a better person, as well as a better writer and so on. And with that in mind, I love what you were saying, Jordan, about the persistence. That is one of the qualities that I talked about in Stoking the Creative Fires. And yet I've come across this one little reminder, almost a mantra to give to my writing students over these last many years. And that is to ask yourself, what would disappear forever if I didn't write it? Was it an encounter with your grandmother when you were young? Was it falling in love on one of the Greek islands? Was it a political insight? If you are on fire about that, you will be able to go all the way and see it through. And if you have moments where you're battling the great dragon doubt, ask yourself that question again. If I don't finish this story, essay, poem, script, it will disappear forever and the world won't know about it. If you can isolate that and honor it, and I mean that with all my heart, if you can honor that feeling, that insight, you will be able to finish.
Phil, that's terrific. And we will leave people with that for a few moments. We're going to take a quick break. And I truly mean that is the best recap for the first half an hour. And we'll come back to that in a minute. I want to remind you, you can still be part of this. You can give us a call at 805-549-8855. You can email us at voices@kcbx.org. Sarah's going to jump in and take things over for a moment, and we'll be back with you real shortly.
Thanks for tuning in on this Thursday, September 3rd afternoon for Central Coast Voices. If you have questions you want to have answered, you can send them to us at voices@kcbx.org by email or call them into us at 805-549-8855. We'll be back with more Central Coast Voices in just a minute here on KCBX.
Welcome back. I'm glad you're with us today. I want to remind you that KCBX is in the middle of our quiet pledge drive. Obviously, we're skipping the lengthy pledge breaks and trying to keep everyone safe, so we don't have volunteers in the studio to take your calls. Actually, it's kind of tough to not have more volunteers around during this COVID pandemic, but we want you to still be part of KCBX. We still need your support, so we were looking for ways to help have you help us serve the community through these times. Our goal is to add more members to our family. You are our support, and you are what keeps KCBX alive. We'd like you to make an investment in KCBX so we don't have to go on and have another pledge break. And we're doing our best to try and keep the family together and moving forward. You can give us a call at 805-549-8855. Or you can reach us at kcbx.org and be part of the community. If you're not a subscriber now and you're listening, there's probably a good reason why you do listen and enjoy what we're doing. So we'd like you to be part of that group too. Today we are talking with folks from the Central Coast Writers Conference. As I said to them before, and I'll say again, that I said it on the break, and that is I love having writers who love to talk about their craft. And believe me, if you get a chance to go to the Writers Conference, and Terry will tell us more about that also, I can assure you that our two guests, Phil and Jordan today, along with other writers and true teachers of the craft will be at the workshop. And even though a lot of you are scratching your heads saying, oh, gee, another virtual event, I can assure you there'll be people there who are instructors and writers and fellow travelers in that craft that may not have been able to attend if it wasn't a virtual event, because everybody can't move all over the world instantly. But I can assure you that Jordan can be at a workshop in San Luis Obispo and a workshop somewhere else in the world on the same day, and nobody loses out. So I appreciate the fact that they're doing that. It came to mind for me as I was thinking about preparation for the show that and I won't mention any authors or the book, because I don't think that's fair to basically pick on somebody that I didn't care for the style of their book. There's a particular author who wrote a book, a nonfiction book, which I tend to read mostly nonfiction. And I listened to an online presentation of his introduction to his book, and it was fascinating to listen to. And I can now tell you I've had the book for over a year, and I am about a third of the way through, because I'm surprised at the fact that this particular author has a fascinating interest in his subject. And when he does an oral presentation on it, it's very engaging. But it became very difficult to sit down with what amounted to material that I didn't think was as dry as it should have been. So I'm wondering how you shift back and forth between fiction and nonfiction at times, and how you shift back and forth between oral presentation and written presentation, and make them both work together. I mean, this is an author who was doing a rather lengthy presentation, about 20 minutes, on his own book, and it was fascinating. And then I went to read the book, and it's like, I can't get through it, even though I'm very, very interested in the topic. Does this come up often for you when you're talking to writers about what does or doesn't fit for them?
Jordan, go ahead.
That's a good question. I think a lot of it is trial and error, in that, you know, sometimes maybe you learn this stuff by doing it. And I will say, for instance, speaking and teaching, while I love to be in front of people, teaching did not come naturally to me in the beginning. And I learned and stumbled a lot, or presenting, if you want to put it that way. And for some people, it really does come naturally. But for me, it was a learned skill. And I would say different parts of my brain are turned on when I'm doing fiction or nonfiction. So I think for writers, I think with everything, you really have to suggest that writers sort of follow these impulses. Do you have the interest in learning to be a speaker? Well, then, you know, practice, try it out, you know, watch a bunch, do it yourself. I never tell people, you know, don't do it. For the book you're sort of obliquely referencing, I think sometimes, you know, sometimes writers are actually better when they're talking about it from the kind of off the hip, you know, just the parts of it that are inspiring to them. So 20 minutes, you know, you really don't have that much content to go over. But in a book, you have to write 300 pages and you have to cite sources. You know, some things don't translate as well, and some people's talents don't translate as well. Just like, I think it's true that not every writer should teach, not every teacher can write, you know, et cetera. But I really think it's worth sort of finding out by doing. I'm a big fan of throw yourself into it and find out the hard way, but that might not be, I don't know. Phil, what's your approach?
I often use baseball metaphors. I was raised on baseball and myth, and then the myth of baseball. Some players coming up are trying to be pitchers, and then the manager discovers that they really should be in the outfield. Some infielders really want to pitch. With writing, I've often found over teaching 30-odd years, I began teaching screenwriting at the American Film Institute, is that some people writing scripts are in it for the glamour, and what they really want to write, or what the writing is telling me, is the story wants to be a novella. I read some novels, and I realize it's so picaresque and picturesque that there's a screenplay in there dying to come out. So what I'm trying to do, and what I think Terry has set up with a conference like this, is we want to help you find the voice for the story that you are obsessed about, in the best possible sense of obsession. So we want to stretch you. I was privileged to have Joseph Campbell, the famous mythologist, as my mentor. I wrote The Hero's Journey about his life, and the book and a movie. And I remember him telling us once that he was in a Chinese restaurant in Greenwich Village, and he heard some parents lecturing their young child, and then the child taking a long pause after the lecture and just saying, "You stretched me." And Campbell said that was one of the best descriptions of good teaching I have ever heard. It's very different from the didactic approach. Can you stretch somebody's imagination? Ravi Shankar once says, sound when stretched is music. Movement stretched is dance. The mind when stretched is meditation. Life when stretched is celebration. That's what we want to offer potential writers in this workshop. We want to stretch your idea of yourself, your imagination, and your storytelling capacity.
What he said.
And this is why we like to do an hour radio program about a conference. I can tell you, it's truly, we oftentimes have organizations that want to come on and basically talk about an event. They want to talk about a program. And sometimes it's an interesting presentation for 5 or 10 minutes. But it doesn't emote the enthusiasm for the topic that that we do. And the first time we did, Terry, is this the third time we've done this? I can't remember if it's, no, it's at least the third, I think.
No, it's the fifth time we've done it.
I lose track of things, and Chris may have done it a couple times too. The first time we did it though, it's like, okay, how do I get 2 to 3 writers to talk about writing? It just struck me as maybe not being something we could get latched into. But I think it's important to say that, and I'm not trying to harp on, oh, gee, it was the right thing to have you all on today. What I really want to harp on is the fact that if you've never been to a writer's conference and you think that writing is so personal that there's not anything for you to learn from people who may not relate to you as far as style, it's not the case. And I think that the conference has gone on for 36 years now. Terry's been leading it for 5 years. And I think it's truly in an environment. And I would suggest to you that even if you believe that being a writer is a dream unfulfilled in your life, spend a couple of days and walk away with knowledge about this. Just the two presenters that we have with us today, along with Terry, are a good example of the diversity of information that gets shared there. Terry, I warned you about this beforehand because this is the first year that you've done your information to us that you've fessed up to a couple of your own writing things going on. I'm going to leave one of them away. You actually listed you've written... 2 culinary erotica novels. We'll leave that alone. It's his radio and a family show. But I have to, I'm going to read this exactly as your words. You have written a novel about when she ran away with the circus. Well, actually, it was a novel about when you ran away with the circus. So I'm trying to figure out whether or not that's really a novel or that's a novel based upon factual information, or you've decided to just call it a novel because maybe your mother is still around and you don't want her to know what you really did. But I demand an explanation for what running away with the circus is that was in your life that you now classify as a novel.
Yeah, well, I was in law school when I was 21 years old, and I didn't like it. I was slated to become a politician, and so I left school and ran away and joined the circus and was a trapeze artist for 5 years. And now, yes, everybody is still alive, and the biggest part is I've been writing this story since it happened, because it's one of the best ways to stop a party when you're at somebody's house, the cocktail party, is to say, well, when I was with the circus, it just like grinds to a halt. And it used to be kind of an antidote, and in my younger years I was embarrassed about it, but then as I grew older I realized that it was something that not anybody else literally have ever done. So I decided to write a novel about it. And at first it was a memoir, but it is also the time in my life where I was 20 an idiot, as most, I'm sorry, 20-year-olds are. And it was a very difficult part of my life because I got married. I married a trapeze artist. I had children in the circus. I traveled with them. I now have grandchildren that are little circus people. So when it came down to writing it as a memoir, I kept stopping. It just, even though, as like Phil said, it was the one story that was going to die if I didn't tell it, because there's literally nobody else that was from just, from Reno, Nevada, and I ran away and joined the circus. But to keep going, I took a class at the conference and somebody said, it's okay to turn it into a novel. So when I turned myself into a character and her name is Gail, then it was easy to write the stories. So that's the answer to my factional fictional story.
So I suspect it's an elaboration of a factual story, and you're only calling it a novel because someone will find something in it that was a lie.
Oh yeah, well I mean I've got 35 different ex-family members that are still alive. They're not going to like anything that I said, but it wasn't. I'm not hiding from anybody, or I'm not trying to make it so. I'm not upsetting anybody. I'm telling the truth, but this, the only way I could get this done was to turn myself into a character, and it needed to be done. So that's what I've done so far. And it's in the editing process. It may turn out to be different, but the way that I look at it is, the only truth is mine. And there may have been four people at the same event, and each person will have a different view of the event. So I just felt more comfortable saying, this is my story about my story.
Okay, that's a good answer, but it also feels like the answer that came from an almost lawyer in the process. So
no, I feel like I need to back Terry up here, because I think there's one of the things that fiction writers often hate hearing is, oh, did that really happen to you? And while Terry might be one of those who can answer yes, for a lot of people, we take our lives. I think it's Neil Gaiman who says you take your life and you put it in a blender. And a lot of what comes out, yeah, it resembles what you went through or what happened to you. But then you have all this other room to do so much more with it, because it gives you freedom. It's not just obfuscating. So anyways, that's what I have to say.
Thank you, Jordan.
But I think writers should know that too, you can turn your life into fiction.
Yeah.
And it's not
so
lying.
An almost politician, well defended by a gifted writer.
Phil, defend me.
You're telling your truth.
Exactly.
What else is there? One element that can help turn nonfiction into fiction, or what some people are now calling faction, is the element of surprise. I was walking in the Chicago Art Institute once and saw a beautiful stained glass window by Marc Chagall, and underneath it was a simple quote by him, "I paint in order to be surprised." And that sense of exhilaration, the aha that Alan Watts used to talk about, is at the heart of good writing. Because maybe one reason, Fred, you're not finishing this particular book is that the author knew what he wanted to say at the very beginning, and he never surprised himself. We write and we read for a moment of exactly that, what you just did. I didn't see that coming. I surprised, where did that come from? That element of surprise is in us, but sometimes it's squished early on when we were young. And a writer's conference like this is there to help us, give us the courage of our convictions. What is it Alice Walker just said recently? Hard times require furious dancing.
I love that.
Kind of dancing in the imagination is what creates art.
Yeah, and back to my original point of why we're doing this conference is I believe that if you look historically, it's the artists and the writers that heal the collective conscious. And never has our collective conscious been so wounded. Never has everybody been so on edge and so crazy. And so I think that, 3 days of sitting on a Zoom meeting and watching and listening and interacting with these inspirational people will help people share their truths and get us past this collective craziness and onto a path of healing.
Very good point. Thank you. Jordan, I want to interject one. We're almost down to my traditional, I get out of the way and let you guys actually talk without me interrupting you. But I have one other question for you, because I've read some things on your website and some information that you have on there. And it occurred to me, you're a good person to ask this question of. Phil may be also, but we've already bugged him enough today. do you write different when you're writing for a publication like Atlantic, or you're writing for Scientific American, knowing that a good portion of their material will end up getting read online? Do you find that you write in a different style for online audiences versus page turning audiences?
That's a good question. The way in which online writing is different really comes down to, I would say, first of all, length. So, you know, you're not writing 1500 to 2500 word articles online very often. And most of the content that we freelancers produce is going online more and more. There's less and less print journalism happening, and there's greater competition for it. So I do think, and I also think that there's a slightly more, what I would call, conversational tone that might be taken. Although I see that slipping through even into the books. So I've written 6 books on writing craft for Writer's Digest magazine. And I would say there's also becoming more and more a shift towards a conversational tone there, less than a lecturing or, you know, kind of how-to tone. I mean, the how-to content is there, but it's more like, hey, we're in this together, you know, versus like, here's the hierarchy of my wisdom and I am passing it on to you. So I think that's what I would say. But online writing, you know, there are arguments that there are journalists who will argue that online writing has ruined and killed journalism. Because it's true that you can become a journalist for a publication without much journalism experience. And I say that without a journalism degree myself, but there you have it.
Yeah, and you don't even have to put on a pair of shoes and leave the house to show up at a meeting for it. So it's,
no, you don't.
Yeah. Well, we're down to our last few minutes, and why don't you just pick it up there? What do you want to make sure that people don't forget about our discussion today and the conference coming up?
So with me?
Yes, I'm starting with you, Jordan.
Well, I want people to know that this is literally, and I'm not saying, I mean, it is literally my favorite conference ever. Every year I've been fortunate to go for many years, and it has to do with what I feel is first of all, Terry brings an incredible array of people, and these people are willing to just give so much of themselves. So even though you won't be able to sit in the same room with them, I have no doubt that you will feel just like Phil, you know, feels so generous with his wisdom. I feel like you're going to get that same experience. So I also want to say that you had sort of alluded to earlier, you know, if this is the first time or you have doubts about a writing conference, you will get something out of it. And you don't even know what that is yet. And it's waiting for you. And you don't want to miss out on what you're going to be inspired to do, write, or pursue. So I highly recommend it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Phil, final thoughts.
A few years ago, I wrote a documentary about the American Leonardo da Vinci, Buckminster Fuller. And in our film, we found some archival footage where he says, if you give people the right information, they will do the right thing. Well, that was catnip for a lot of activists in the 1960s. And it still holds true to some extent. We need to know, especially at this crucial moment in history, the difference between facts and lies. However, for the world of the creative artist, the creative writer, there is an X factor. It's what I think of as the understory that is glimmering below the overstory. The overstory gives you the facts. The understory gives you soul and spirit, enthusiasm, heart, truth. And that is something that you get at a writer's conference. You're not just getting information about how to write and where to get published. You're getting the X factor of enthusiasm or the lived life. And I think that we will be able to convey some of that as well in these Zoom meetings with each other. So for people who are chiming in from Manila or St. Petersburg, Russia, we will be able to provide you with a fair amount of information, how-tos, how to stay on fire with your work. But what I think we really want to do and what we love to do is to share our deep-seated sense of exuberance for the writer's life.
Thank you. Terry, you get the last word, last word.
I usually do. So I would invite everyone to join this new virtual conference. I know that there is some essence of Zoom fatigue that's going on out there, but ours will be fun. There will be breaks. There will be networking. There will be all sorts of different strange little things that you wouldn't normally get if we were sitting in a room together. And again, with joining the conference, you get every single solitary class as a YouTube link that you can watch later. I also always tell everybody that money is no reason to not join this conference. I have so many scholarships for so many people that if money is the reason that you're not launching your career, that you're not coming to the conference, you just need to contact me and we'll find a scholarship that works for you. This year we have people of color scholarships, essential workers, teens, teachers, we have some at the library, we have LGBTQ ones, and for medical and cancer survivors. So we literally will find a spot that will work for you, and I make sure that anybody that is brave enough to call me, I will find, or email me, I will find a place. You can see the whole schedule at CentralCoastWritersConference.com.
And as I remind people all the time, if you did not get the exact words of that website, if you Google Central Coast Writers Conference, you'll be able to find it, I assure you. And I thank you all. This has been a wonderful program. As I said, it's wonderful to have writers that love to talk about their craft, and because there's never a dull moment, and I thank you very much. I appreciate it. This has been Central Coast Voices. I want to remind you, next week, Chris Kington Barker will be here. She's going to look at, with some leaders in the mental health field, at issues of depression and anxiety and isolation that come about by COVID-19 pandemic. It's going to be an important and interesting and necessary discussion to have. Chris Kington will be back with us next week. I'll see you in 2 weeks, and we'll do our best to keep as topical as we can. And it's a tough time to try and do a radio program, but we've discovered Zoom works even for radio. We are a project of Action for Healthy Communities. We've told you before, and KCBX co-sponsors this program with us to make sure that we can move forward. And you can reach us at voices@kcbx.org. Central Coast Voices is underwritten by Joan Gellert Sargent, and thank you to Terry Bayes and Phil Cousinau, Jordan Rosenfield. I appreciate it for a wonderful program today. Writers Who Love to Talk is delightful. And thank you to Sarah in studio with us. She gets to be there and do all the controls because they don't let us in the building at the moment for very good reason. This has been Central Coast Voices. Coming up next is my favorite program, This American Life. Thank you for joining us today.